The next case of the morning is number 05-1118, Alan O. Moore, Sr. against Battaglia. Ms. Fritz.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Wendy Fritz, on behalf of the petitioner Alan Moore. We are seeking the reversal of the dismissal of Mr. Moore's habeas petition and remand of the case for the following reasons. Mr. Moore was denied the constitutional right to meaningful access to the courts when he was denied the opportunity to obtain a copy of ADPA, the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, from the prison law libraries. Under the particular factual circumstances of Mr. Moore's case, which do all relate back to the arcane law of ADPA, he should be entitled to statutory and equitable tolling of the limitations period. In Lewis v. Casey, the Supreme Court affirmed the constitutional right to meaningful access to the courts, finding that it was the touchstone to the constitutional rights retained by a prisoner, those prisoners that seek pro se to bring claims of their constitutional rights being violated. There can be no meaningful access to the courts and no meaningful habeas challenges by prisoners when a prisoner's claims may be immediately dismissed for failing to satisfy a technical requirement that a prisoner could not have known. In this case, Mr. Moore missed the one-year filing deadline for a federal habeas petition under Section 2244D1A of ADPA. He had no knowledge of ADPA and, significantly, no opportunity to learn of ADPA's technical requirements because the prison law libraries where he was confined did not have ADPA materials.
Ms. Fritz, is there anything in the record about when, if at all, Mr. Moore got access to a copy of the AEDPA?
No, Your Honor. It seems that he did not get access to a copy of ADPA. He obtained his knowledge of ADPA from the orders that the district court issued dismissing his petition and then responding to his subsequent letters, adding information and asking for reconsideration. That's how he learned of ADPA's requirements.
One other question that I had for you, because the brief seems to imply that his first habeas petition that was filed in 99,
yes, Your Honor,
was dismissed as premature, and the government states that it was dismissed for lack of prosecution. Am I misreading your brief?
No, Your Honor. The district court did dismiss the first habeas petition 5 months later after it was filed for lack of prosecution.
But your brief implied that it was dismissed as premature.
Yes, Your Honor, because Mr. Moore did continue to pursue state post-conviction relief. So when he filed his first habeas petition in December of 1999, what we now know based on the record is that there was a petition that seemed to have been concluded in December of 98, but he did also continue pursuing state post-conviction relief after that. And so for this current petition, the last order that we have is an order from January of 2002.
Let me just ask you something. If we were to remand to develop the record on the state of the prison library at the time, just before his habeas petition was due, do we need to reach any of the merits issues?
Your Honor, before remanding, the court will generally affirm whether there is facial merit, because there has been no record developed, there have been no arguments. So the court does not need to substantively reach the constitutional issues that were raised in the petition.
Well, if the case went back for development of the factual record and the district court found that Mr. Moore had access to the AEDPA from the get-go, so to speak, that's the end of this case.
Yes, Your Honor. The case could actually be resolved fairly quickly upon remand. As an initial matter, that's what we would be looking for, would be either some type of development of the factual record or an evidentiary hearing based on what the state could put together from the prison law library to see whether the AEDPA, any materials were present in 2002 and 2003 that Mr. Moore would have had access to.
And if for any reason the library was inadequate, then the district court would go on and reach the constitutional issue?
Yes, Your Honor.
Before it comes back here?
Yes, Your Honor. The case would then proceed as a standard habeas petition, and there would be the pleadings and then the further development of the record and an actual look at Mr. Moore's substantive claims, which include conflict of interest, inadequate jury instructions, and a third claim that he has.
At this juncture, what do we know about his status in the, we'll say, the month or so? I think his time expired January 31st, something
yes.
like that. What was he, is this an access to the court or simply access to the library or simply a matter of the library was inadequate? Was he in confinement that he didn't have access to the library, for example, or do we know that?
Your Honor, this is not a claim that he was so confined and so restricted that he had no access to the library. It is ultimately a claim that the library was inadequate. Now, if you look at all of Mr. Moore's declarations, being a pro se prisoner and not necessarily knowing what he was arguing to, he did try to list all of his circumstances, which, when he was at Pinckneyville, did include restricted access to the libraries. When he talked about Pontiac, he talked about having access to the cell law libraries rather than another library that was available at Pontiac just because of the types of claims that he was pursuing, not necessarily a state direct appeal or something to that effect, but these claims that he was trying to bring in federal court. The actual timeline of events leading up to the filing of Mr. Moore's pro se petition was as follows. Mr. Moore's post-conviction petition for relief was denied by the Illinois Appellate Court on January 31, 2002. Under Illinois Supreme Court Rule 315B, Mr. Moore then had 21 days to get another filing in to preserve his appeal, or until February 21, 2002, to seek to further appeal to the Illinois Supreme Court. He did not pursue this. And then over the course of the next year, Mr. Moore was confined in the Pinckneyville and then the Pontiac Correctional Facilities. And then on or about February 19, 2003, the next year, in the midst of one of his civil suits before the federal court seeking relief, Mr. Moore wrote a letter to the federal district court claiming insufficient evidence and otherwise making claims concerning his conviction. The district court told Mr. Moore that his letter was an improper attempt to reopen a habeas case that he had filed in December of 1999. The response to that letter was actually filed under the first case number, under that first habeas case. In response, Mr. Moore then sought instructions on how to properly file his habeas claims. The court sent him the habeas forms, and on March 5th, shortly after he got those forms, Mr. Moore signed and submitted his Section 2254 habeas petition. Then, a couple months later, the court sua sponte dismissed Mr. Moore's habeas petition for untimeliness. The state was not brought in to the case, and no record was developed. So the court was completely in reliance on Mr. Moore's unrefreshed recollections of the history of his case and the facts of his case, and that is what the record before this court now is based upon.
You mentioned some other civil cases.
Yes, Your Honor.
He had a number of them, didn't he?
Yes, Your Honor.
So he was doing some kind of legal work.
Yes, Your Honor. We're not arguing that an inadequate prison law library, something like a prisoner needing to have access to all legal books and to all laws. We are arguing for specifically, and when you look at Lewis v. Casey, it is talking about things like habeas petitions and actually being able to draft complaints and petitions and to know the procedural requirements for getting a complaint into court and past the initial procedural hurdles so that the substance of claims can be heard. Mr. Moore had cases before the federal court. He was, among other things, he was suing the estate of his trial attorney, the attorney that he now has a conflict of interest claim in his habeas petition for. He has a prior drug conviction that he was pursuing post-conviction and state habeas relief on. He has other suits where he's suing the normal police department. I believe that relates to his, possibly to his unlawful arrest claim. So he has, to the extent that he has understood the law and he has had the access to know what types of claims that he can bring, he has been pursuing relief in whatever form that he can from the courts, both state and federal. I see that my time has run out. If I could possibly reserve some time.
Your time had expired at that point, but we'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal, right?
Thank you, Your Honor.
And if we'll add 2 minutes to the time for the government as well. Saunders.
Good morning. My name is Catherine Saunders. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Illinois Attorney General's Office on behalf of the Respondent Warden. There's no dispute here that the petition's untimely on its face under 2244D1A. And because petitioner can't demonstrate that he was prevented from filing a petition, he cannot bring himself under D1B and entitle himself to a later start to the limitations period. Petitioner also cannot show on these facts that he's entitled to equitable tolling. And therefore, the district court properly dismissed this petition as untimely under Rule 4.
You know, I mean, if we cut to the chase here.
Pardon me? I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. If we, you know, go right to the bottom line here, it just seems inherently unfair to hold pro se prisoners to the strict deadlines of the AEDPA and then, you know, prevent those same prisoners from having access to it. Does the government have a position as to what the Constitution requires in terms of allowing prisoners access to AEDPA in habeas proceedings? I thought it was really interesting when, you know, it was noted that even Judge Mim, with his wealth of resources, was having trouble figuring out, you know, the proper deadline.
Statutes of limitations just simply aren't unusual. They govern all sorts of civil actions in this court and all the other courts of appeal that simply held that pro se prisoners are held to the same standards regarding limitations periods such as that. It's just simply the law, and especially in the context of AEDPA, where the Congress has said we really need a one-year limitations period to encourage the finality of state court judgments.
But, I mean, it's so Alice in Wonderland, isn't it? You have to know everything about the statute, but you can't see the statute? Imagine.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You don't have to know everything about the statute, and I agree. Really, short of notice pleading, but really in order to file a habeas petition, you really just have to put your claims, you know, on the form from the district court, and that will suffice. Petitioner's allegations in this case fall well short of establishing that he even looked for the AEDPA, much less that it was unavailable, although on appeal he's represented that it is not available to him.
Right.
Even if it wasn't available, in order to invoke D1B, he's got to show that he was prevented from filing a petition. So whatever
well, but
the state
what if it turns out that the reason, you know, that he misunderstood or miscalculated the deadline was because he couldn't do any research on when the statute begins to run and when it is told? I mean, oughtn't we to toll the limitations period under a situation like that?
Pardon me?
Oughtn't we to toll the limitations?
On what basis?
On the basis that he couldn't do any research because he didn't have the statute.
Well, he hasn't established that he didn't have it, but we have to establish that he was prevented from filing. The petitioner appears to be arguing for a per se rule that if the AEDPA is unavailable, then he's demonstrated a D1B impediment. But that construction of the statute really conflicts both with the Ninth Circuit's opinion in Whalum Hunt and with the Fifth Circuit's opinion in Edgerton. Neither of those cases created such a per se rule. Instead, they really held that where it's unavailable and the petitioner had no actual knowledge, then its absence may constitute a D1B impediment.
Well, isn't that what we have to find out by remanding?
No, not at all. Because this court has held in Lloyd versus Venata and Powell v. Davis that although we're not sure what a D1B impediment is, whatever it is, it has to prevent him from filing. There has to be a causal connection between the lack of the information in the library book and the inability to file. So therefore, the Fifth Circuit has held in a case similar to this that where a petitioner files before he says he had access to the AEDPA in the library, there's simple that causal connection is absent, and therefore the lack of the AEDPA just did not prevent him from filing.
Would the government agree that the AEDPA is particularly complex?
I understand the petitioner has characterized it as arcane, quoting other courts as not petitioner's characterization. Probably so, but that's really neither here nor there for this purpose. It is a statute of limitations, and pro se prisoners are held to the same standard regardless. The bottom line here is that because he cannot demonstrate that he was prevented from filing, he simply can't invoke D1B to entitle himself to a later start to the limitations period. He's also not entitled to equitable tolling. In order to be entitled to equitable tolling, you've got to demonstrate that you've been diligently pursuing your rights and that some extraordinary circumstances stood in your way.
And an extraordinary circumstance would not be that you don't have access to the very statute that you need to plead from. That would not be an extraordinary circumstance.
My understanding is petitioner in his brief has cited his lack of knowledge, lack of legal training, lack of legal resources, none of which has ever constituted grounds for equitable tolling. And although the court in Whalum Hunt, the Ninth Circuit, held that this may be a situation where equitable tolling is warranted, this court should find that that's distinguishable on its facts because the AEDPA at that point was brand new, and here by the time petitioner filed it was no longer so new.
Does it matter how new it is if someone has never had access to it? I mean, would it matter if it were 100 years old or a year old, if it didn't exist in that person's milieu? I mean, the prison library, maybe you should just empty it of all statutes and then of the prisoners will...
In order to be entitled to equitable tolling, the petitioner would have to be able to demonstrate that he was diligently pursuing his rights, and this petitioner cannot. He suffered dismissal of his first and potentially timely 1999 habeas petition simply for the fact that he didn't respond to the district court's request for information, despite being given a second chance and being warned that he would, in fact, suffer such dismissal. And secondly, when his state post-conviction proceedings ended in January of 2002. He waited over a year after that to come back to federal district court. So he's simply not going to be able to establish a right to equitable tolling on these facts. The petitioner explained to the district court that he didn't file his 2254 petition because he didn't have his discovery materials or his trial transcript, because the law library wouldn't help him, and because he didn't have state law materials. None of these allegations warrant equitable tolling. Petitioner's allegations, in fact, do not demonstrate that the alleged absence of the AEDPA mattered to him at all. He never alleged that he looked for it and couldn't find it. And so, therefore, this case need not be remanded. Because even if the court were to remand, because he filed his petition before he alleges that the AEDPA was available to him, he'll never be able to show that causal connection. That is, he was not prevented from filing. And no matter what he would allege on remand regarding the library, he'd never be able to demonstrate that he had been diligently pursuing his federal claims.
Well, he would have to show that the information was not available in the library, wouldn't he?
Pardon me?
He'd have to show that the information was not available in the library. Not that he couldn't find it.
He'd have to go one step farther than that, Your Honor, and show that he actually attempted to look for it. The mere absence of it in the library, if he never looked at it, really would not cause him to file a late petition. It would have no causal effect there.
You aren't arguing that he has to look outside of the prison library.
No, I am not, although he could. I mean, the courts, Bounds versus Smith doesn't require that certain documents or books be in the library, and prisons could experiment with ways, you know. I know other courts have said, well, if you can ask for it for interlibrary loan and that sort of thing, but no, he would have no duty. But by the same token, the library, the state, has no duty to notify. Because petitioner can't demonstrate that he was prevented from filing, he can't bring himself under D1B, and because he can't demonstrate that he's entitled to equitable tolling, the district court properly dismissed his petition as timely. Courts after Whalum Hunt that looked at the equitable tolling situation have held that lack of knowledge or notice regarding the limitations period is simply not grounds for equitable tolling. And other courts, the 5th, the 10th, and the 11th circuits, have held that an inadequate prison law library is not grounds for equitable tolling. And therefore, if the court has no further questions, we'd ask that this court affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you, Ms. Saunders. Ms. Fritz, I have one question for you. Was there a proper allegation here that he was, in fact, prevented because of the absence of that statute from the law library? The district court, on page 11 of your appendix, doesn't seem to think that there was a proper allegation made.
Your Honor, yes, the district court found that the case was distinguishable from Whalum because he had not made specific enough allegations. Now, this is what he alleged. He alleged that the prison law library at Pinckneyville, where he was imprisoned in 2002, he stated that after having learned of ADPA, he stated that ADPA was not available, so he had no access to ADPA and could not get his legal work filed under the restricted conditions of Pinckneyville. Regarding the prison law library at Pontiac, Mr. Morris stated that the books were very old, but that the law had changed, which would certainly include ADPA. Which would include the AEDPA, although he did not specifically reference it with regard to Pontiac. And he, for the Pontiac prison, he suggested that the court look to, for itself, do some type of evidentiary hearing to find out what was there in the library. Now, when you look at a prisoner's allegations, as the district court, it should have kept in mind that pro se petitioners should be, their allegations and declarations should be looked at liberally. Whalum, in fact, particularly found that there should only be a dismissal if there were no facts or if there was nothing that could be inferred from the facts that had been alleged by the petitioner that would support some type of tolling. So that's what that's the type of standard we would be looking for here. We're not arguing for a pro se rule. We are arguing for a very fact-specific rule regarding access to prison law libraries and access specifically to some very critical material such as ADPA. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Fritz. Thanks to both counsel in the case. Ms. Fritz, you were appointed in this case, and you have the thanks of the court for the very fine job you have done on behalf of your client. We also thank your law firm for having expended significant resources on behalf of this case. Thank you. The case will be taken under advisement.